Hey everyone, welcome to the latest episode of Come This Far. It's a podcast where my friend Chris and I talk to really cool people. And Alex Grodd fits that category big time. Tell the listeners, I didn't even know this, so you hired him to do a live podcast at your New School's Confab, I think, right? Remind us how you've
He gives me more credit. I was not really involved at all, even though sort of coincidentally, I had already been listening to his podcast, which is called The Disagreement, which everyone should check out. We spent a lot of time talking about that with Alex, but he did one. We had my organization, New Schools Venture Fund, had its annual summit in San Francisco about 5 weeks ago, and we had asked him if somehow we coordinated with him to do a live podcast interview at the event. So it was recorded, and right now you can find it under The Disagreement. The episode is Math Wars, and the whole idea, and I was immediately attracted to it probably shortly after he started doing it, partly because the first couple episodes are areas that are close to home for me. But the idea is that he brings two people on opposing sides of a disagreement together to discuss that. And I think you agree, Sean, like what's so attractive about that is that muscle in our society is atrophied. People can no longer, you know, enter into or engage in any sort of disagreement.
And I argue because it's all done on social media or whatever. And, it, you know, you can be anonymous and, you know, not really have to engage the other. And, I just think anybody that's listening to this opening, this is a fascinating guy. He's, you know, this is his second entrepreneurial initiative. The way he thinks about what he's doing and the level of diligence that he's bringing to this whole process of getting us to talk to each other when we're on different sides of an issue is great. Is just
what we need.
Awesome.
Right.
Yeah. Big time.
We landed the three of us together on this notion of curiosity being a value that we really need to engender in our kids and in ourselves. So he's definitely doing that. And when I mentioned two of the first three episodes, there was one on ADHD, which I really liked. And not everyone's going to like, you know, maybe either side of the disagreements in these things. But the other was on nuclear power, which I gave Alex a hard time about a little bit.
The end of life one too. I mean, medical.
The end of life one's good.
Medical end of life. Yeah. I just want to say, Kira, I mean, just to remind the listener, I mean, Men Living, we make five suggestions for how to live life fully, and living curiously is one of them. And so we're all about that.
You know, another episode where we attract someone to talk to us who's a little bit smarter than we are. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder sometimes if, you know, people like that leave and like, why didn't you know?
No, you say that all the time. You say all the time.
But those two knuckleheads.
Yeah.
Well,
they're curious.
That one knucklehead. That one knucklehead.
but that's the other value of curiosity, right? Like, even if you're talking to someone who is interested and curious, even if they don't know anything, is a pleasure to talk to.
I like to think that. Right.
We fit there. All right, here we go. Alex Scott. All right. Yes, this is
great.
It's so funny. Like, part of me is tempted to just be like, hey, let's compare notes. Like, tell us what your process is for your podcast, but we're not going to get into that boring shit. We're going to.
Okay. Yeah. I'm game for, I am ready for anything. So
you're in the right place.
Wherever you take it, I'll meet you.
Yeah. Great. Well, Alex, meet Sean. Sean, Alex.
Nice to meet you. Do you guys know each other?
We do, as of about a month ago.
Yeah. Okay. And you met at your thing, right?
When Alex had done the live Math Wars episode of The Disagreement.
That's which, as of yesterday, is our most popular episode.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, I want to get all into that kind of stuff. Like, as we try to figure out like what it is we're trying to do with the podcast and how do we know when it's successful, et cetera. But anyway, great to have you. Super fun. You notice we're recording. We don't do a lot of editing on our show. I don't know how you guys roll, but it just kind of flows.
They're way more professional than us.
Probably. Holy. Welcome to if you've come this far for you know, run by a couple of dummies. Okay, so wait, so you're in, you live around Boston, is that right?
I live on the border. I live in Somerville on the border of Cambridge. We're a third of a mile from Harvard Yard. Mm-hmm. So very, very close to, you know, that whole scene. And I've been here for most of my adult life. I did 3 years in Atlanta when I did TFA Atlanta. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I've been in Cambridge or Somerville for like the last 18 years.
Did you go to school in Massachusetts too?
I did. I went to school in Cambridge. You know, did.
You can say it.
Not super coy. The half coy version of the worst conversation to have. We're off to a terrible start.
We're going to scrap the first 15 minutes. So it's awesome.
But yes, I went to Harvard. So I've been in this area for a long time. I really love it. I could see myself stay in the course till there is no more course. So
are you going to the parade today? I just want to know.
Oh, you're here.
So you're probably not going to the parade.
No, Chris can fill you in. I can fill
are we going to have a disagreement right now? Nice. And I'm going to be on the win. And I'm going to win because there's 18 banners up.
There's no disagreement. It's just, I grew up in Western Mass, which is on the border of Connecticut. And so, you know, there's a lot of people like both my parents from the New York area, in my town. So I grew up as a Knicks fan, which was really amazing in the 90s. It's been, and up until this year, really, it's been pretty horrible. But this year was amazing.
It was really fun.
It was awesome.
So I went to Holy Cross in Worcester, and I was born in Lowell and spent the first 20 years of my life in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. So, but I've been in Chicago for now 30, at least always, my wife always says, you never get it right. You always say, oh, 25 years. It's been actually 38 years now. So,
But you know what's funny about this is it's a lot like Alex's story because Sean, your son, Jack, never lived in Boston, right? And he's a hardcore Celts fan.
Hardcore, born here in Chicago.
It's funny how that all works. Also, Sean, I was listening to an episode and it was really entertaining to hear you go with the hot. I think you said hod, and then there was a fire and tired that was like hardcore Boston. So it's like, you know, you speak the Queens and then drop your R's every now and then. And I appreciated that.
Yeah, well, I haven't confirmed that you went to Harvard, but
Well, and think, Alex, how long we regretted naming this podcast if you've come this far. You know, it was hard for a while. So we're always interested in people's stories, Alex. And again, you and I don't know each other that well. You may be connected with Becky Crowe through the Ed space. Do you know Becky Crowe?
I know of Becky Crowe. I definitely sort of met her at various old school, new schools summits and sort of Ed Reform circuit, but don't know her well.
Becky's a really good friend of mine. She co-founded Bellwether with my wife. I've known her for a long time and she was on the podcast, but she, it turns out, is the niece of Bill Bradley. Is that right? Am I getting that right, Sean?
I believe that's right. That's what we
found. And of course, the reason I'm bringing Bill Bradley up is because you have some association with Bill Bradley. Is that right?
I do. In fact, you can see it. This isn't great for the podcast, but you can see me walking.
Oh, there he is.
Right there. This was in the New York Times. This picture was actually in the New York Times during
this. No way.
I started off as a summer intern the year before I was going to college and ended up getting a job and deferring college for a year. And I ran Manchester, New Hampshire. I was his field coordinator in Manchester, New Hampshire for a year as an 18-year-old.
Holy shit.
Yeah. It was wild.
Were you just a political wonk even in high school? Is that what led to that? Or?
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't very wonky, but I was very into politics. I sort of saw myself on a political trajectory of some sort, wanting to be involved and wanting to use that as a vehicle to make a difference. And so I went and got an internship with the New Hampshire campaign and was one of the first, you know, dozen people on that team. And yeah, I mean, it was wild. I mean, it was probably the most fun year of my life. I mean, it was really, it was crazy. I mean, political campaigns in general are crazy. And, you know, back in 99, it still had a lot of the old school political, like, campaign feel. And so for an 18-year-old to just be hanging out with all these real grown-ups and like working on a mission, you know, but political campaigns are like war. It's like going to war. It's just you either win or lose, and you wake up every day trying to win. And so it was phenomenal until we lost. that it was not as fun. But I'm
curious, do you have a sense, either through friends you may have that are still in the game or whatever, about how that's changed? I mean, I think I have my own hypothesis.
I honestly, like, after the Bradley campaign, I became less interested in politics. I did a little work in college, but it actually, that whole nature of winning, you know, like just pursuing victory at all costs, and a lot of the, just, you know, the, it's a game and it really feels like a game when you're playing it, and it just wasn't well suited for my temperament, like all the spin and the hyperbole and the propaganda and all of that. And the Bradley campaign was probably had a lower degree of all of it, but it didn't really suit me. But I had an amazing time. So the answer is, I haven't been on many campaigns over the last decade, but, you know, looking back on the Bradley campaign, it was primarily white men running the whole thing. I think that has largely changed. It was super boozy, like just every night, like that kind of, you know, old school vibe every night at the bar, karaoke, you know, you work 12 hours, you drink for 4 hours, and then you go do that for a year. So that, you know, it had that vibe. I think that's likely shifted in many ways. And, you know, it was probably like, things are much more data driven now. Like we were just kind of, we had some voter lists. We would call them when we felt like it. We'd knock on some doors occasionally. Like, you know, it was, I imagine, much less technocratic.
Than
it is now.
So, I mean, obviously we want to talk a lot about the disagreement, but you've spent the bulk of your career on a company that you founded, you know, and I don't know if anyone can spend 15 plus years doing anything without it informing their identity quite a bit. So don't want to gloss over Better Lesson. I was wondering if you could tell us that story, and maybe it involves TFA, maybe it doesn't.
Yeah, it definitely involves TFA, because I really came up with the idea for Better Lesson, which, to be clear, is not a very unique idea. I feel like almost every teacher that has struggled with lesson plans, it's been like, hey, there must be a better way to share them.
Well, two things real quick, Alex. Yeah. First of all, TFA for folks is Teach for America. And secondly, it's often not about the idea, right? It's about execution. So
yeah, totally. And that, right. And I think my idea was the execution layer. I had the first day of my summer institute summer teaching was third grade science in Houston, and I showed up and I was like, I truly asked my sort of supervisor, all right, where are the lesson plans? And my supervisor at the time was like, what are you talking about? Like, you create them. Whoa. And at the time, there's just something about that felt off, but, you know, I didn't know any, I hadn't studied science in, at that point in, you know, 6 or 7 years, and I wasn't very good at it to begin with. So I just like the idea that I was creating the pedagogy from scratch, it didn't make any sense. So really from that moment on, I started to become obsessed with the problem, which plagues so many teachers and still does. We did a good, you know, we are doing a good job at Better Lesson and helping out and putting a dent in it. But like, of like, what do you teach? How do you create those materials? How do you personalize the lesson to the needs of your various classroom? And so, you know, for me, it was like 2 years of teaching in Atlanta, sixth grade social studies, and coming up and needing, going through that vicious cycle every night, spending hours, and then often not creating a great lesson, which is a total nightmare as a teacher. I mean, every teacher has been through that experience of, you know, being 15 minutes into a 50 minute class and being done with your lesson and just having, like, right. Yeah. So it just, there was a lot of that with 30 sixth graders. And so, you know, after 2 years there, I moved to Boston. I taught at Roxbury Prep, a very high performing charter school, but I was then doing it again. And so I think for me, part of it was like going from the Atlanta public schools to a very high performing charter and seeing that the problem was still as acute or more acute. I mean, within high performing charters, there was at that time, kind of 2007, a culture of spending 3 hours each night on your lessons. There was this sort of like Nietzschean ubermensch of a teacher that is going to overcome every obstacle and just, you know, work 100 hours and get it done. And the whole, it was so, both personally upsetting, and it just didn't make any sense. So anyway, that was the founding impetus to then try to create a different approach to what was sort of a whole graveyard of failed lesson plan sharing companies.
And so, and give us the sort of like high level story of, I mean, Better Lessons still around. Yes. I'd be a little curious to hear if you all are at least thinking about implementing AI into your product development. But how's it going over there?
Well, my 14 years of Better Lesson, there's sort of two phases. You could divide them into two phases. The first 7 years, we were really focused on lesson plan sharing and trying to develop a business model around open educational resources. So what ended up happening was we developed an amazing website. We had, you know, hundreds of thousands in some months, millions of teachers coming to our website as accessing our lessons. But we were, and we experimented, you know, it's an interesting sort of case study. We experimented with some premium models. We had a premium layer that we sold to KIPP and Achievement First and a lot of the high performing charters and became sort of integrated in their workflows. We did a lot, but we couldn't really develop a repeatable, scalable business model on the open education resources. And so, you know, about 6 years into it, we pivoted and built a full-scale professional development company focused around virtual coaching. And to any entrepreneurs out there, I do not recommend a hard pivot of your business model 6 years into growing the company. It's not ideal. But then that business really took off and it's been really successful and it has grown at, you know, an exciting clip. And I brought in a new CEO, Matt Kennard, a few years ago, and he's continued to grow the business. So, you know, so now Better Lesson is much more of the focus is on virtual coaching, virtual events, teacher professional development.
So why do you recommend, it was obviously the right
worked
thing
out.
Why do you recommend not doing it?
Just the details of the cap table, like the dilution. Yeah. It's, you know, you're 6 years in the company and you've raised millions of dollars and then you go from whatever your business model was to zero revenue. Yeah. And then, but you own a fraction of the company and yet you're starting over. It's just from a financial outcome perspective, it's very suboptimal. From pursuing our mission, it was just part of an iterative journey, and I'm really proud of where we landed. But it's not ideal if you're running a company to pursue financial returns, which is what it is.
Do you still have, because I was on the site, do you still have a repository for lesson plans, or did you
but it's just not, it's not,
it's a site,
it doesn't get a lot of love. I mean, we still get a lot of traffic, but it doesn't get the love.
So before we get into the next chapter of your career, which is again the main reason how we came together here, I wonder what the exit was like for you, or you know, the genesis or the evolution of how you decided it was time to do something else and move on from Better Lesson.
Yeah, I think the, you know, the simple answer is I think at a certain point we reached. Like, I like building stuff. I like creating stuff. I like the first few years. I like zero to, you know, a million. I like a zero to 5 million. I think once we got to that sort of product market fit and a lot of the company began just chasing the next bar graph, you know, the next whatever revenue target you and the board set. And it's about hiring more salespeople and, you know, just creating, you know, tight org structures and communication systems. It just, at a certain point, I sort of knew that was not what was going to keep me fired up. And so, you know, we had a bunch of really good years and then, you know, talked to the board. I actually, you know, talked to the board at the end of 19. And we had a whole plan in place and sort of the day that, you know, my co-founder and I were going to announce that we were both gonna start a search process was like the day Tom Hanks got COVID. And so we ended up pushing it back like a full 9 or 10 months. And then, but then we ran a great search and found Matt and it's been great. I think founders have all sorts of different approaches and strategies and relationships with new CEOs they bring in. Depends how much we want to talk about. I could talk about the transition and the different like emotional strategies and identity, like, you know, sort of evolutions and things like that for a while. But, you know, I think for me, it was like, I got a lot of good advice. Like once you're out, you're out. Focus on empowering the new CEO, focus on supporting the new CEO and, you know, move on. And that's sort of what I have done. Yeah.
I'm curious about your talk about accomplishing the mission, and it would be great to do. We could spend a bunch of time talking about the state of education. And I'm just curious if, you know, if you feel like your Better Lessons is impacting education globally in a positive way.
You know, I think that's a long conversation.
Yes, I know.
I think that, you know, I'd love to have it because I do think, especially, you know, Chris, at New Schools, like there was a theory of change in education, early New Schools theory of change, you know, air quotes, ed reform movement that existed and was coherent. And I was deeply a part of and believed in and that theory of change has withered a bit. And I think it has not been fully replaced with something new. At least I don't know what that is. And I think, so it's hard to answer that with like in a vacuum. It's hard to say like Better Lesson, I think, made sense within an old theory of change that is no longer as relevant or viable. And I am interested in the conversation as to what the new replacement is. And so anyway, we don't have to go deep on that, but I do think it's an important one for us to be having.
I mean, I'm super interested in that. I'm super interested in the process of a founder leaving a firm and setting it off in the right direction. But what I'm more interested in is what it was like when you came home. I'm guessing the little people I can see in the photos behind you are your kids. Is that right?
Yes. They're 4 and 7 now. That's like one of my favorite pictures from when they were little babies. Yeah.
Well, and so, I mean, that was probably a gift that you had a little bit more time to spend with them, but also what was the exploration like in terms of what's the next thing for Alex?
Right. Well, I took a 9-month hard sabbatical. And I say hard in that, like, for nine months, I like woke up every morning and I had like my 9 to 5 while the kids were at school. And I had nothing on my calendar for 9 months. So ooh. I would just wake up and I would look at a blank calendar and just meditate on the joy of that. And so I needed, I think that was really important. I happy to talk about like sabbaticals. It's obviously like, it is a luxury good to be able to take a sabbatical.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
For me, I actually worked on a novella, a short novel, and I wrote for 4 or 5 hours every day. And it was just, it was the perfect thing for me to just cleanse myself of, you know, like 14 years of running a startup and help with the process of moving on and developing a new identity and all of those things. And so I wrote a novella. I finished it. I shared it with some people. At some point I would love to, you know, try to, I don't know, do something with it, but, but then I had to, you know, get a job and figure out what was next. But that's
How old were you when you took the sabbatical?
It was end of 21, beginning of 22. So I was 41.
41. Okay.
40 going on 41. Yeah.
And it, you said, oh, I had to get a job. But at any point, did you wake up one morning and looked at the blank calendar and said, shit, I need some stuff. I need some stuff on this calendar. I need something to do.
Because I am very well suited. Not everyone's like this. I'm very well suited to just spend 8 hours alone tinkering with like some writing and reading books and stuff like that. It's just like, I think there are a lot of people that is, you know, would be give them hives. But for me, especially after 14 years of like managing a 65 person team and all of that and raising a lot of venture capital and whatever, it was like profoundly therapeutic.
But I can feel your energy and so I'm thinking, okay, you had that quality where you're like, okay, I'm going to start, there's a problem, I'm going to start a company, I'm going to fix this problem. And I don't know. I don't think you lose that. So at some point, I mean, I know you're writing a novel and whatever, but at some point it feels like, and maybe you're going to tell us about it with the disagreement, you're like, okay, I see something I got to fix or I got to do. Well, and my next thing,
there was a parallel path during my sabbatical, which was the pandemic and the culture wars playing out. And so, well, you know, I was writing and I, you know, look, I think there was like a small part of me that's like, oh, maybe this thing will be amazing. And, you know, I have this inner talent that I've never, whatever. And
I'm the next Stephen King, right?
Yeah, whatever. I think like, so, you know, I sort of, so that was always there, but for the most part, I knew I was going to have to kind of figure out what I wanted to do next. And the parallel path during the sabbatical was just right in the sort of, you know, it was the end of 21. So it was still fairly like acute pandemic, high culture war toxicity. I live here in Cambridge. I was very concerned about schools, the school closures. That for me as a former urban educator, it was very clear from the beginning, it was going to be a massive unmitigated disaster for particularly low-income kids and kids of color. And so, you know, from the beginning of the pandemic, that was a thing that I wanted to speak out about. I wanted to engage people. And at various times, it just was not a conversation that was easy to have, particularly with progressives and people on the left who had fallen into a pretty binary, like, you know, whatever the Republicans were saying, like, you know, we're on the other side of it. And it just, my disagreements, my ability to disagree on something like school closures, but it was also about other things. Like I, you know, just the various sort of lockdown-ish measures. I had friends who were whose businesses were closing, and my daughter was 1 year old and being masked, and it wasn't that I was coming at these things with strong conviction. The school closures I did have strong conviction on. Everything else, it was more I was wanted to have conversations. I wanted to explore what was the best way to handle a lot of this uncertainty, and it just I was unable to do it. Like the conversations would degrade very, very quickly. I was called names. I was called reactionary. I was called contrarian. I was called alt-right at one point because of the masking, like just raising the question about a one-year-old going on two-year-old having a mask and the pedagogy and like the whatever. So that was the parallel to, so I had the serenity of my open calendar and my like creative tinkering. And then I had this like growing tide of just like emotional destabilizing toxicity amongst my close family and friends and people I'd never had any issues disagreeing. And that was sort of the foundational experience for thinking about the disagreement and starting to develop and prototype different ideas for it.
Were you, had you been a podcast listener in that at any point before that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that was the other thread for the disagreement is that I'd always been like a decent podcast listener, but like many people in the pandemic just had more time and and so I started listening a lot and I started trying to really deliberately cultivate a very eclectic, promiscuous diet in terms of the politics of the people I was listening to, their approaches, their styles, because I, you know, like many, I was just really struggling to know what was what.
Yeah.
And the, so the two sort of founding origin stories for the disagreement, one was this, my disagreements degrading with friends and family. And I'll tell you what the second part of that story is, but the other one was realizing that in the world of podcasts and the world of media more broadly, almost everything I was listening to was some form of mutual affirmation. It was hosts bringing on people who they agreed with and the people agreed with them. Yeah. And they would have these sort of love fests. And like, no, it's all good. There's a place for that. And I learned a lot. I still listen to mostly. That's what I spend much of my time listening to, because you can learn. But for me, there was always this phantom, like running, lurking on the side of anything I was listening to, which was like, there is another perspective. And there's another perspective that likely has some wisdom or has some truth or is worth engaging with and creating some dialectic that you can then synthesize and form a position versus the sidesiness, we're over here, we're over there of most of what I was hearing. And I think it was those two experiences that, led me to want to create a different kind of conversation, which is our tagline, but I didn't even mean to do that, which led me to want to be like, what would it be like if you had that same smart person, but instead of the mutual affirmation, you had a host that was a little more neutral, maybe had some thoughts, but like, and then you had the other sort of, side to the story, and you brought them together and you integrated them and you sort of saw what it looked like when there was balance and perspective and, sort of intellectual and epistemic checks and balances. And so that's the story. And also my novella was not very good. It was not that good. So I had to do something else. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm still holding out hope, actually.
I'm sitting here wondering if your wife has said, "Oh, honey, this is really nice," but no,
It's another story. She doesn't want to read it because it's sort of a little bit of a memoir and whatever. So she has not read it, and I think likely never will.
Hey, listeners, if you enjoy our show, please consider following us or sharing the show with a friend. And I want to take a quick second to shout out our sponsor, Half Acre Beer Company, from their iconic Daisy Cutter Pale Ale to the refreshing Bodum IPA. All of the beers that these guys are making are a testament to quality and to their passion for brewing. So cheers to Half Acre Beer Company for supporting if you've come this far and for brewing great beers. And now let's get back to the show.
So there's two things about the disagreement, though, that I think is interesting. And you know, as you're an entrepreneur, and my understanding is the podcast is, or the way that I'm looking at it is, a podcast is kind of the marketing for a mediation or training educational business. Do I have that right? I mean, at some level, you want to. You want to have some impact on others in the way that they engage in conversation and sharing of ideas.
Yeah.
Correct?
I think the podcast is serves an important mission within the broader mission of the company. I think the goal of the podcast is to celebrate and normalize healthy disagreement. So the podcast is not about implementing the tactical best practices that have been developed around how to disagree interpersonally with your in-laws, or it's about, I think what is foundational is showing that healthy disagreement is critical to any problem we want to solve in the world, whether it's interpersonal, political, the entire scientific method hinges on healthy disagreement, the back and forth. So I think the podcast is really rooted in being like, look, conflict is not only a good thing, it's important, and we need to develop the sort of skills and antibodies as individuals and as a culture to engage across lines of difference. And sometimes there are best practices. So sometimes each party will be super curious and will active listen in beautiful ways, but that's not how it's always going to go. And right. We have to celebrate just good, healthy. For us, the on the podcast, it's about, is it in good faith? Is the conversation being done in good faith? Is it being done in an intellectually honest way with evidence-based and real rigor? And does it feel healthy? Is it not degrading into any ad hominem or toxicity and things like that? And that's what we're trying to do on the podcast. I think the broader company, we are very, very interested in bringing and scaling the tactics and the strategies and the skills of how to disagree with in your interpersonal life, in your professional life, in your intellectual or political life, and scaling those. And so as far as the business goes, we're still 3 months into the right. podcast, right. And I'm about a year in, but you know, we are starting to explore two exciting business models. One, with the help of Chris and New Schools, who really helped kick this off, is we're starting to do more and more sponsored live recordings, live events, and we're starting to work with foundations to actually sponsor podcasts, bring them into life, and say, look, we would love to build a body of knowledge around whether the ethics of eating cows, right?
Yeah.
I've talked to a climate change philanthropist who wants us to do a podcast on whether to eat cows. So there's a business model for them to sponsor that. We still maintain our core principles and our editorial, but they bring it into life. And there's, I've talked in the past week to a half dozen philanthropists who are, super excited to bring interesting, important conversations that would not otherwise be had into the world. And so thank you to Chris. Thank you to Francis. Thank you to Cameron and the whole team for helping to kick that off. The other thing that is we are super excited about, but obviously, like as an entrepreneur, we gotta keep our focus. But that we started working on is a civics curriculum that's based on the podcast. It's incredibly simple. We have teachers and we have students who love the podcast, and it's a simple concept. You have kids listen to a version of the podcast. They do curated research. We teach them some skills around how to disagree, the tactics, and then they do their own disagreement with a classmate or with a family member, and they upload it to our YouTube page. So that's going to be amazing. We're just trying to figure out how
that's great,
how to fund it and scale it. Any funders out there, holler.
So Chris, before you go, I'm just curious, Alex, as you thought about launching the business, did you consider at all where podcasts were on its life as a vehicle, as a medium to say, you know, how are they still hot? Are they dying? Are people getting sick? Did you look at that at all as your vehicle to do that?
No. So, you know, I never intended, and, you know, I prototyped for the first 9 months, so many different business models around this. And like, but I never intended to just do your traditional podcast advertise, you know, like, you know, advertising or Substack premium thing, because, you know, it seemed limiting. Obviously the podcast industry is not in the best place, but I knew, like, when I was starting, I knew that.
Yeah.
I think for me, it was always just the quickest way to prototype these conversations, because it was the cheapest and quickest way to test. Can I do it? Like, I'd never done anything in media prior to 3 months ago. So I, you know, it was like, how can I test if the idea is there, if I'm there, if like the vision is there? And so podcasting always seemed like the quickest minimum viable product.
Yep. Makes sense.
I have so many questions, and I know we're going to run out of time, but this notion of the trend that we've lived through in terms of things being, I love the term you use, sidesiness. The sides being so much more divided, so much further apart. That's certainly one contributing factor, but also I feel like there is a declining ability to address disagreement, which it sounds like you're sort of trying to at least set an example for, whether it's the kids or any listeners. And yet it takes a lot. One reason why people don't like to sort of engage in disagreement is because it takes a lot of emotional energy. So my question for you is, as the host of this podcast, and you're what, 10 in now, is that right?
Yeah, I think it'll be 12 on this coming Tuesday. Yeah.
Okay. How is that going for you? Like, how is it been to bring two people from different sides of a disagreement together, and how are you feeling?
Well, you know, I think the high level answer is, like, just for me personally, outside of and the business, the mission or whatever, I absolutely love this work. I mean, if I could do this, there was a way to just like not build a business, not worry about scale and mission and revenue, like, and I could just do a like really interesting, contentious disagreement and host it and do the whole process where I get to do the matchmaking. Like, so our process is, there's very intensive matchmaking to find the right two people. We have about a 3 month cycle to match them, because it's not just finding not one, but two experts. It's finding two experts who have the right conviction against, like, the right polarity and conviction that are in the same intellectual weight class and will talk to one another, because that is the biggest challenge in our current culture. And we'll get close, we'll get on the edge, and we'll be like, okay, we have this person locked in, now we have this person, but I got to wait to the end of the conversation. I'll be like, all right, well, we have this other person for you to talk to. And I always sort of do it somewhat sheepishly and whatever. And then, you know, I'd say 50% of the time they're like, oh, I'm not talking to that asshole. Like, I'll never. Really? Like, yeah. So, and then it's back to the drawing board. And I guess maybe the asshole part is maybe 25%, but then the other 25% is just like, oh, it's not a good fit, or I know him or her and whatever. So the matchmaking piece of this is truly the special sauce and what I spend much of my time on. It's like being, you know, I say it's like being a Jewish Yenta matchmaker, just constantly looking for, you know, soulmates. And because, again, and it's not just like that they'll do it. It has to be the right chemistry, the right vibe, the right match of style and conviction. So there's a lot that goes into that, but I love it. I mean, I think it's super fun. I get to kind of just talk to lots of interesting people and think creatively and strategically about the matches. Then there's research. And so for any episode, I do a ton of research. I do a deep dive and try to become, you know, kind of a surface level expert in whatever the topic is. And then the conversations are so fun because you have no idea how they're going to go. I mean, it's really every, you just sort of put it in motion and then it, you know, develops a life of its own and you just kind of ride it out and try to rein it in whenever possible. But like for the most part, there's really like a very unique energy and momentum that each conversation just takes on.
Do you feel like you're getting better at it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think getting better at it for us is like across the board. It's like getting better at the matchmaking, getting better at our thesis about the type of people we want, getting better at the research and prep, and then getting better at the actual hosting. But yeah, I do feel like I'm getting better at it. I think there's a lot of room for improvement. And, you know, we're treating it as a product. I'm treating it no differently than like a software product. So we're iterating, we're testing, we're measuring, we're trying out lots of things. And yeah, I mean, I think the big thing that I am better at is I am, to your point, earlier point, I am much more comfortable on conversation 12. And it's really conversation like 16, because we had a bunch of them that we didn't work.
You didn't do.
It's with the conflict itself. Like the first one we had, the first like really hot one where it was like real conflict was nuclear energy. And the Stephanie, who's great, like she's an anti-nuclear activist, was just her body language. She was like flopping down on the chair at various times. She was very put like, and I just remember I like sweat through my, and I'm not like a big sweater in general. And I'm like, at the end of it, I was just like fully drenched. And now it's more comfortable. That's one of them. And then, you know, there's like tactics to interviewing that I'm learning and not great at yet, but.
What's your cadence for posting? How often are you trying to do a show?
I mean, we're doing almost weekly now, which is kind of insane. And the key for us, and this is like the big thing that my business partner, Catherine Cushenberry, has done one of them. She did Medical Aid in Dying. She's actually recording one right now on UFOs and extraterrestrial life.
Oh yeah.
The top two people like in the country. It's really,
oh my God, I can't wait for that.
It's going to be so good. So I think a lot of the way we scale, what we've learned is it's really more the model and the guest pairing than it is the host. I think like we're bringing in a Harvard Law professor to do another, to host some of them. Our vision is to build out a Peloton instructor model of hosts so that, that we can scale people with expertise in certain areas so they can go deep and so that we can turn this really into like a TED for healthy disagreement. And it's less about a podcast with a neurotic Jewish host that does whatever.
Neurotic Jewish host with a voice for radio, right? Like you sound like you belong on NPR.
It's so funny because I've never, you know, I did some random podcasts for Better Lesson, but I've never done it. And like everyone, I hate the sound. Like I hate hearing my voice.
Of course, I don't.
Yeah. And then a bunch of people started telling me, like when we were doing the prototype and listening, they're like, "Oh, your voice is like, that's great. I'll take it." Yeah. I'm 43. I wouldn't have known that, but I, you know.
Alex, what's up? I mean, I know, well, no one is immune to criticism, feedback, et cetera. So and by the way, I feel like someone who's bringing together the two sides of an argument ought to be more immune than others from disagreement, right? Because you're not a one-sided, you know, disinformation machine. But can you talk about like, have you gotten criticism that eats at you or that is hard to take?
I mean, yeah, I think each conversation, when we design the conversation, we go through a process and we're like, what is the topic? Right. And then it's like, what is the grain size? Like we did one on immigration. In hindsight, I think we should have done one on border policy or like an immigration survey thing, but like, so, but you think of like, what is our point of view? Do we have a point of view that we're looking to probe or push? And then you design a conversation. And I think we walk a fine line between wanting to put forth like good faith experts who we think, or anyone we put out here, we're not doing it for the sake of it. We think their arguments and their points of view are worth engaging. But at the same time, we have and we will put out people who some of their points of view are potentially noxious to many people, including myself. Right. And so we've had a couple close friends, you know, the Israel one I did, which was very different. That I don't know if you heard it, but I got involved personally in it. I got involved personally. I'm just not doing that again. But that there was some real tough conversations. You know, there's been a couple others where we, one of the people, some people felt was outside the bounds of platforming, or, you know, that the conversation could have been designed with someone just a click inside that person to have the same result, but not bring into, you know, bring whatever sort of noxious side of that person.
Did you agree with that? Did you agree with that feedback?
No, I didn't. Yeah, it was very hard. It didn't. I mean, I had the conversation. It was a very hard one to have because it involved someone's, you know, personal identity, and it involved their, and someone who in their mind questioned and threatened the identity of, and this has happened a couple times. And, you know, it's a hard conversation. I listened and I was appreciative. But at the same time, we're trying to push the envelope a little bit. Yeah. This is not, you know, this is not for everyone. And we're trying to walk a fine line. You'll notice like we've done a lot of left on left disagreements because I think that's often where I am most interested in. But, you know, we are now venturing out into other territories. And I think like I am working through my own personal issues of putting more ideas into play that I find in various ways, you know, from on a spectrum of uncool to like harmful. And And, you know, I don't know. We're feeling it out. It's hard. The criticism is both hard, but for the most part, the vast majority, and there's selection bias here, but the vast majority and overwhelming response has been like people really love these conversations. They're really unique, and it allows people to engage on issues in totally new ways and seeing both sides. And so, like, you know, there is some collateral damage for any individual on any conversation, and we're just doing it. I'm posting, you know, right after this, I'm posting on LinkedIn our affirmative care, our gender affirming care episode. Mm-hmm. And I've got amazing feedback, but I also anticipate getting some that, you know, potentially of the nature that we talked about. And, you know, I'll learn from it. I'll take it. I'll learn from it. But we're still going to err on the side of engaging deeply with different and sometimes uncomfortable perspective.
I just think, you know, I mean, I don't know what you guys think, but I just, if we don't explore, you know, the position that is opposite us with total curiosity, how do you have this conversation? How do you have this disagreement if we make, oh, you know, we're a couple of degrees away from each other. Is that really moving the needle? It's got to be, how do we really explore the opposite ends of the spectrum almost?
Yeah.
Hard work, Alex.
Studied philosophy and I always think about things in dialectics. It's important to understand kind of what exists. And then it's important to complicate it and lean into a more nuanced, complicated position somewhere in between. And what's been really exciting is that's what, you know, I hear from people all the time that they say like, look, I was listening to this and I was going back and forth and I was like all in on this person. Then I was all in on the other person. And in the end, I didn't know what to think. And I was like, well, that's a start. Yes. You know, that's kind of a beautiful thing.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think the dialectic and framing the dialectic is really important to just beginning to form what is like, what is the right position and synthesis or compromise or consensus or policy approach or whatever. So we'll try. We'll keep trying.
I mean, I eventually I'm going to have to get this tattoo that I've said I'm going to get on this podcast several times, but it's the Walt Whitman quote, be curious, not judgmental. Because I think that's the most disheartening part of our society these days and the cause of our inability to reduce the gap between our disagreements is people aren't even curious enough. And there's this whole disinformation machine that happens, and people are so willing to believe things without questioning them. That's probably, we'll have to save that for episode two of this whole thing.
because I know we got, I can't leave this without saying, because you know, the issues of, you know, what is an expert? What is truth? I mean, all those things, you know, for me, factor in different sides of the, you know, conversation. I mean, I listened to the one with Catherine and end of life kind of decisions. And it's like, I have very strong opinions about that, but it's like, okay, what a lot of those two experts, so much of it is how they feel and their opinions and what is true for them versus being experts. And that's what makes the conversation really interesting.
They're humans, right?
Yes, yes.
I think also what we're trying to do, and this is part of the model, is, and this is the math, like, is start to do some series and do deeper dive. And any individual conversation is going to be a spark of some sort, but it's not it's not going to allow you to really wrestle down and adjudicate all the whole thing. So we are interested in starting to do some series. Like we just did, coming out Tuesday, we did a criminal justice reform disagreement between Chase Aboudin and Rafael Manguel from the Manhattan Institute. So Chase is the DA, San Francisco DA, who was recalled, progressive prosecutor. Rafael is a Law and Order Manhattan Institute person. And there's just so many things. I mean, the conversation was amazing, and it's also like ridiculous to talk about criminal justice reform in 50 minutes. So the same even with math wars, there are so many other layers to math wars and things like that. So one thing we do want to do, and this is where, again, foundation, we're like sponsor some series, some deeper dives into these things. And you should get the tattoo, Chris, because I agree. Curiosity for me, my number one learning in the past year in all this disagreement, that is the master value. It is the center of the bullseye. Totally. If you can summon authentic curiosity heading into any disagreement, it will go in the top 10% of outcomes that are available. Sometimes those are still bad, depending on the nature of the disagreement, real genuine curiosity is the key driver of all healthy disagreement. Yep.
Agree. And by the way, it's also closely linked to empathy too, right? Like if you're not curious about how other people are experiencing the world.
It's linked to everything. Open-minded. Yeah. Look, if you feel curiosity, you're going to be open-minded. Mm-hmm. You're going to be more empathetic. You're going to be actively listening. You're going to do all the other things. It is, to me, and in our curriculum, our How to Disagree curriculum we're working on, it is like, that's the center of the bullseye.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the three of us should just all commit right now to all of us getting that tattoo.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's all do it together.
Boston. Lisa won't let me get
my tattoo, my Jewish mother would yell.
Wow, we're at time. Do you have a few minutes to go over, Alex?
Yeah, I could go. I could go till whatever.
Okay. Can we ask just a few more questions? Sean, do you have time?
Yeah.
Okay. Just a couple more. Like, I'm curious how long the backlog is of disagreement ideas, of prospective disagreements. And can you share that spreadsheet?
Yeah, I will. And honestly, we want to do a better job of engaging like the community and getting more feedback. I mean, right now, you know, we have a basic pipeline, we call it, of topics. We treat it almost like a sales pipeline where you have the top of the funnel and you like in progress, close one, you know, like because of the 3-month cycle and whatever. But I think we have about 12 in our high priority right now, which high priority means like we are going all in on them. Of the 12, we probably have 8 that where we have one person that we feel good about and we're just off searching for the the match, and that's where the 3 months come in and a lot of the other stuff. So we have 12 high priorities. We also are, we haven't done this yet, but we are trying to, in that 12, there are two that are a little lighter fare. So we are doing one on a cappella. Just to,
what? Like college a cappella groups?
Yeah, because people hate, like, there are people that truly hate a cappella.
That's so true.
And people that love it. And I just, we need a break. Like, yes. Criminal justice reform and we just did white privilege. So there's another like feminist debate that's kind of like fringe, but not fringe, which is whether porn, looking at porn as cheating in a relationship. So we are working on that one just, but you know, the rest are, so we have those 12, happy to share. And then we have, you know, probably another 12 medium, which are like ones that we will elevate, likely elevate at some time. And then we have a parking lot of like 100, because, we'd love to do it on like Henry Kissinger, The Disagreement, you know, we'd love to do it on books like Proust or whoever, like movies, Godfather 3, you know, So I think like we'd like to do, and that's where the Peloton instructor model comes. We can get more people, we can have more quantity, keep the same bar of like rigor, even on like a cappella, like we would treat it like, you know, you make your arguments, like come in, ask hard questions, whatever. We probably in the spreadsheet right now, we probably have like 75 topics. And we just had one of our listeners, one of our like, it's pretty fun, like, you know, kind of like super fan listeners submit a iNotes, like iPhone notes thing of 40 ideas for us, which are all amazing. So he just texted it to our producer
yesterday.
That's
great.
So yeah. And then a lot of people send in random ones and things like that. So happy to share.
The question I was going to ask you before, when you were talking about your process for getting your two guests, have they all kind of, the ones that have opted out, have they opted out themselves or have you, and then have you had to tell someone, nah, this isn't going to work, or have they all removed themselves from the process?
No, I mean, the most common thing is that we will lock in one, an anchor person, right? Yeah. So it's on either side, but we will find someone that we're excited and someone will jump, say yes first or express interest first. So then we lock in that person. Then a number of things can happen and they always do happen. One is we can look for another person. We can find someone that we really like, but they say, I won't talk to that person. Then we have to decide between the two. And so we have to decide whether we cut that person loose or we go back to our original anchor and be like, sorry, we're going to find someone. And it all depends on the nature of the market, like how much supply there is. And the reality is there's almost always a lot of supply on the center left to center right to have these disagreements. The progressive left, it's just for a number of reasons we could talk about. This is not like in any way pejorative, there's much less supply for certain disagreements. And so we have to factor that in when we're deciding who to match with. So I think it goes all sorts of ways. And you know, it is like dating, you know, sometimes we have to keep people in the mix a little longer and see how things play out. We try to be as ethical and communicative in our process as possible.
Yeah.
But it is, I mean, it's like anything you gotta, there's some gray area in terms of,
I'm sure that most are coming in with the mentality of like, I'm going to win this disagreement, right? I'm going to win this argument.
It's one of our rubric elements. So we have six rubric areas for guests.
Of course you have a rubric because you're a former educator.
Teacher, we have a lot of rubrics. We have a rubric for the guest, a rubric for the pairing, the nature of the pairing. We have the topic and all of the elements of the conversation, like how much conviction, is it high conviction on high conviction? Is it medium conviction on high?
Sure,
conviction on high? Like spiciness of talk. Anyway, we have a lot of rubrics. But for the guests, one of the rubric areas is mission orientation. And so we do try to get people that recognize we are not trying to do a just scorched earth debate. And most of, you know, and we code our conversations. Most of our conversations are, you know, from spectrum of scorched earth debate to incredibly, you know, thoughtful, common groundy, like curious exercise. Mm-hmm. They're all in between, you know, they're all over the map, depending across the 12, but we are trying to orient people away from it. And I do, when I have a 5 bullet points I go through at the beginning of the conversation, that is one of them, that this is a different kind of conversation. Yeah. You're going to want to persuade, you're going to want to make your points, but like, be open-minded, make sure you're active listening. And I think when you listen, even this, the one with Chase Abunin and Raphael, which gets very, very chippy and very argumentative, you know, I still think they were having fun and they were doing it in good faith. And there's like a layer that we're looking to maintain, even though that one does feel more debatey than, say, you know, the ADHD one or, you know.
I don't know if I told you this when I saw you in San Francisco, but I was a nuclear submarine officer. And so for the nuclear power episode, I was craving an engineer to be in there. But the point that I think this is making me aware of is my other prospective tattoo is listen better. Because if you go into a conversation, you're like, my sole purpose here is to win this fucking argument. You stop listening to what the other person has to say.
That's
because it doesn't matter.
Look, if you take all of the literature on disagreement, and I've read a lot of it, all the HBS books and case studies on negotiation, you take all of the work in restorative justice and couples counseling, whatever. I mean, it really comes down to, and again, curiosity is a more, get that tattoo first, because if you are curious, you will listen. If you're actually curious, you're going to listen.
That's right.
And it's like, but it all comes down to that. Like if you had to summarize the entire oeuvre of disagreement research and strategy and tactics, it does come down to that because, and like, you know, I am, and this was the second part we didn't get to, but like after I had all these terrible disagreements, I got a coach on this and I started working and developing a practice. And I went back to a lot of the people where I had some toxic disagreements or got name called. And I went in and I like literally would stand outside the disagreement before I have it and try to cultivate curiosity and try to like have it be authentic. And when I did that, it was incredibly successful. Like we had really good outcomes. And it was the same, even with my wife, we were on very different pages when it came to the elements of the pandemic. And I didn't realize it at the time, but I wasn't curious about where she was coming from. I wasn't listening. I was throwing like Emily Oster data at her, being like, it's not that bad. It's worse. The car ride is more dangerous. Da, 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 da. And, you know, once I made the shift and I listened and we went on a walk. We went on an hour walk and I didn't say a word. I told her in advance. I was like, I'm not going to say a word. I'm just like, I want to absorb. And it was, you know, it was pretty profound and it's been way better. So
what's it like to have disagreements with your wife? I'm kidding. Of course.
Well, you know what? I'm much better at it. I'm much better at it after going through that reflection. Cause a lot of us, there's a lot of us that are just debatey and go into debate. It's not helpful.
So Chris, I'm wondering, are you going to go for a full sleeve tattoos or are you just going to do a whole back?
These are not big tattoos. This is like this is like 6-point font. It's like it's like a cheat sheet where I can look at my arm and remind myself.
I thought you would have a big one with a picture of Whitman on your back too, like the whole thing.
No, I love it. I love you. John Mayer. Do the John Mayer full sleeve.
Full sleeve.
Yeah.
Musicians do that anyways, Chris. You know?
Well, so you know who else does? Soccer players. Those guys are crazy with the sleeves. Alex, it's great to spend time with you, man. I love the disagreement. I love the way you're thinking about how you're living and all that good stuff. And I love that you got, is two girls back there? Is that, you got a boy and a girl?
So an older boy and a 4-year-old girl.
Awesome.
So yeah, it's great.
Awesome. Before we go to our three canned questions, is there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to cover?
No, this was super fun. Like I said, this is really like my first podcast interview. So
wow.
This is great. This is great. I mean, I did them for Better Lesson, but it was all like, you know, propaganda, yeah. Corporate propaganda and whatnot. So this is the first time anyone's asked me like, you know, random personal questions. Yeah. So no, this was awesome. I loved it.
Well, you know, yeah. we're sort of sprung out of a men's group that Sean and I are both pretty heavily involved in called Men Living, non-faith-based men's right. group. And it's a bunch of dudes who are trying to be better husbands, better friends, better fathers, et cetera. And so that's kind of the genesis of this whole thing. You may know that we ask these three canned questions.
I do. I prepare. I mean, I didn't know if they were the same one because I listened.
Are
they the same? I would have prepared. Okay.
You know what? I'll edit the part out where you said you prepared, but I appreciate you listening.
Yeah, I did. I listened to the most recent one. It was great.
I think a lot of people who live thoughtfully think about these things anyway. So preparation is not a worse thing. All right. The first question is, what do you wish you could have told your 10-year-old self?
Okay. Two things. The first is like when you experiment with edible marijuana, wait an hour and a half before taking another one because you're not feeling anything. Like give it a full hour and a half. I think that that would be my number one.
Someone had a bad experience, huh?
A couple. You just gotta wait. The second one that I did think about that's related, but like it would just be about drinking. I really would tell my 10-year-old self that, like, you know, whatever, you know, it can be fun, it's great, like, but you know, don't black out and don't get in cars with people that have been drinking. It's just, it's whatever. Yeah. That's what I would say, because I was in a suburban like high school in the 90s, and there was just, I look back on some of the just some of the things I did, and like incredibly grateful that just nothing.
You got lucky.
Yeah, right? I just got lucky, pure luck. And I think like booze, and I don't drink very much anymore, and I'm not, you know, I'm not judgy, and I had a great time with booze at various points in my life, but I think it would have been like have 4 beers instead of 14. You know, like that's. That I don't know that that's what I would say, but it would be something like that.
I was thinking about when you were working on Dollar Bill's campaign, and you're like, oh yeah, it was really boozy at night, 4 hours of drinking. I'm like, wait, you're 18. I think
it was New Hampshire. It was Manchester, New Hampshire.
I think it was 21, but yeah, you know, no, sorry, exactly. New Hampshire
doesn't count.
Doesn't count.
Doesn't come for that, or doesn't come for anything. What are we saying here?
Easy guys.
I love it. Those are two of the most pragmatic.
Yeah, they're practical,
messages.
But yeah. I do think that, like, I think the booze one is like it's high stakes. Like, you know, I didn't, and again, I was not like a crazy, you know, party boy or anything. But like, there was definitely times where I made some decisions that. Work could have ended up not good, and so it's high stakes. The advice would be high stakes in that regard.
I love that. Alex, do you have a mantra in life or a mantra these days?
I was thinking, like, it made me think of like those No Fear t-shirts where it's like second place is the first loser. Work hard, party hard. So this is potentially derailing. I'll just share it, and then maybe if we want to talk about it another time, I do like talking about it. Honestly, my mantra for most things, like both in terms of my own self talk and how I think about engaging with others, the curious one we've already covered. So this is probably the right there is that I think about free will as an illusion, that I have no free will and others have no free will. And I believe that's true. I actually believe that to be true, but regardless of whether one believes it to be true, it's actually a really nice way to eliminate hate from one's life, to think about the world in kind of a consequentialist lens. But, you know, the idea of retribution, the idea of hate, it totally dissipates, and it allows you to just sort of appreciate people for who they are. They are some combination of their genetics and all the environmental factors over which they had no control, and just appreciate them and treat and meet them there. So again, there's a lot more to it, and I'm sure this sort of freaks people out, the concept, but
I mean this has got to be on the list of disagreements, right?
Just a very hard one to have. I've heard a bunch of debates on it, and I need to figure out the right way to have it, but it is on the parking lot now. But
so I raise it a lot in the men living meeting gatherings that I hold as the subject on the table. Did you read Sapolsky's book?
I heard a couple of his podcasts. I read the Sam Harris book on free will.
Yeah.
Which wasn't a great book, but I love, it's just very dense and whatever, but I've listened to a lot of Sam Harris on this topic and then read various things. And then it just started to make sense to me. It made sense to me again, both because I do think it is true. And as Sam says, the illusion of an illusion the illusion is an illusion. Like if you look close enough, I have no idea when I'm going to stop the sentence. I truly don't. I just stop at some point and it's pretty mysterious, but even if you don't buy that, just the ethics, if you play the game of what would it be like if we were all grizzly bears, you can develop sort of a sense of justice and a sense of ethics that is, I think, allows you to sort of upload everything that you care about in terms of social justice, in terms of law and order and safety, in terms of love of family, and totally discard hate, retribution, and some of the worst impulses that we have. So anyway, that's... I don't know that was a lot. But it is true. That's sort of my mantra.
That's consistent with what I would expect from a Harvard philosophy.
Bachelor's. I'm playing to the type for better, probably for worse. Apologies.
That's great. I love it. Last question is, what do you hope that people will say about you at your wake?
So,
And in the wake of the last question, maybe
I mean, I think that I would like people at my wake. You know, I think I would like people to say he maintained a comedic sensibility throughout most of his life, and he never took anything too seriously and was able to appreciate the profound comedy and the fact that we exist, that consciousness exists, that we're all here doing this. And it's just so absurd, the absurdity of it all, that he at least calibrated the absurdity and worked that and factored that into his overall orientation towards the world. I think that is my... That is my goal. Also, he helped the United States learn to disagree. But outside of that, I think that's probably what would mean the most to me.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Sean, anything else before we let this guy go?
No, it's Alex. Thanks for coming and hanging with us. It was great, great conversation. Look forward to the next one. And best of luck with everything, because it's not only cool work you're doing, it's pretty, pretty damn important too. So
amen to that.
Good luck. Yeah.
Well, thank you both. This was super fun. Would love to do it again sometime. We can talk about parenting.
That's right. Yeah. There's something. We'll definitely stay in touch.
Yes.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, Alex. Take care. Peace.
This is Chris. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of If You've Come This Far.
And this is Sean. Remember to check us out, mnliving.org.